Frequency in the music causes the brain's audio cells to rewire themselves in a way that makes the tinnitus less audible. So the ringing is technically still there, but over time, it fades. This moment of science comes from Indiana University. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amomentofscience.org, where you can also view videos and sign up for podcasts. For A Moment of Science, I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41 in sports. The Big Ten tournament continues in Indianapolis. At the half, Illinois led Wisconsin 29-20. The winner of this game will play Ohio State. Ohio State earlier today defeated Michigan. The score there, 69-68. Indiana State will take on top-seeded Illinois State today in the quarterfinals of the Missouri Valley Conference Women's Basketball Tournament. The Sycamores beat Southern Illinois 73-57 in the first round. The Chicago Bulls continue to fade out of the NBA's Eastern Conference playoff race, dropping their sixth in a row last night and finishing the game without their best player. Derrick Rose had to sit out the final three quarters of the Bulls' 111-82 loss at Orlando after spraining his left wrist in a midair collision with Magic center Dwight Howard. The Bulls are at Miami tonight, and Rose has been ruled out for the game. The Bulls say tests performed today confirmed the sprain, but showed no breaks or ligament damage. Rose is listed as day-to-day, meaning he could play Tuesday when Chicago visits Memphis. And the St. Louis Cardinals and Boston Red Sox postponed their game on Friday because of rain, and they agreed to a rare spring training makeup date. Boston and St. Louis will split their squads on March 22nd, adding a game in Jupiter. Stadium officials were expecting one of the largest crowds of the spring today, spring training games. The Red Sox are playing Tampa Bay in Fort Myers on March 22nd, and the Cardinals have a game in Kissimmee against the Astros. Both teams have adjusted their pitching plans by adding B games on Saturday against their minor leaguers. That's sports.
WILL programs are made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes the Great Impasta.
It's 2:43. This morning, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack launched a series of workshops probing antitrust issues in agriculture. Some big agribusiness firms say the forums will showcase a well-functioning free market. But as Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports, many producers think they will expose a system hostile to the traditional family farm.
25 years ago, Montgomery County, Missouri had about 200 independent hog farmers. Now, there are two. Jim Foster, with his old open-air hog barns, is one of them.
Bought this in 63 when I got out of college and got married and been here ever since.
It hasn't been easy keeping this rambling operation together. Big packing companies took over most of the pork production years ago. That drove down prices and drove most of Foster's neighbors out of the industry. He's got just one steady buyer for his hogs now. Meantime, companies that sell Foster supplies have grown just as powerful as the ones he depends on to buy his livestock. That leaves Jim Foster trapped between giants, a situation he blames on hands-off economic policy.
The biggest boar at the trough needs to win, no matter who he lashes out with his tusks and kills, because the biggest company left standing will be efficient, and that efficiency will move down to the consumer. Well, that's hogwash. It doesn't work. We found out from the banks it didn't work that way. They keep that efficiency in their pocket.
Foster thinks the workshops starting this morning in Ankeny, Iowa, mark a 180, a sharp turn in thinking. He's not the only one.
It indicates that the federal government, for the first time in a very long time, is willing to look at this problem area.
Neil Harrell is professor emeritus at Iowa State University. For 30 years, he's been howling about what he calls towering concentration in agribusiness. Now he's found an ally in Justice Department antitrust chief Christine Varney.
Farmers are more and more facing very difficult day-to-day issues of surviving economically, and I'm very interested in looking at the factors that contribute to that difficulty.
There's also an investigation. The Justice Department and at least seven state attorneys general are probing Monsanto, the world's largest seed company. They're looking into whether Monsanto's used its patented Roundup Ready gene to kill off competition and jack up prices. Monsanto spokesman Lee Quarles says today's hearing will show that it hasn't.
We believe an objective review of the agriculture sector will reveal that competition is alive and flourishing.
Quarles says the farmers wouldn't pay for Monsanto's seed traits if they didn't work. But something's killing family farms. About 80,000 mid-sized operations disappeared just in the last 5 years. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says he wants to know just how much consolidation in agribusiness contributes to that decline.
We're going to try to find out if there is a correlation and whether or not when agribusiness purchasing power is reduced in the hands of a small number of companies, does that create such a unlevel playing field that it compels those in the middle to either get bigger or get out?
Back on his farm, Jim Foster enjoys his grandkids, but worries if they'll have a future in agriculture. That's why he's in Ankeny this morning to testify at the workshop.
Yeah, I'm not interested in one guy farming our whole county. I'm interested in a lot of young families with swing sets in the backyard raising kids. That's what it's all about.
Foster thinks there's a better than even chance that the workshop starting today may rebalance the marketplace and give mid-sized operations like his just a little more clout. You have to be optimistic, he says, but adds that decades from now, he doesn't want to have to explain that back in 2010, he didn't even try to save the family farm. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
It's 2:47. You have flame-retardant chemicals in your body. Americans have the highest levels of anyone in the world. The chemicals are in the dust in our homes and offices and schools, and they're showing up in our food. In the second of our five-part series, Rebecca Williams takes a look at what these exposures might mean for our health.
They're called PBDEs. That's polybrominated diphenyl ethers. They help keep foam and plastics from catching on fire. They are absolutely everywhere. They're in your car, they're probably in your couch, your office chair, your TV, your drapes, the padding underneath your carpet, your hairdryer, your cell phone. The problem is, they don't stay put. They leach out of products, and they're getting into us. They're in dust and soil and the wastewater sludge that's spread on farm fields. The chemicals are in fish and meat and dairy. They've been found in the Arctic and Antarctic. They're in peregrine falcons and killer whales and polar bears and salmon. They're in cats and dogs. Babies come into the world with these flame-retardant chemicals in their bodies. The chemicals have also been turning up in breast milk. 6 years ago, Meredith Buhalis had her breast milk tested as part of a study of new moms, and PBDEs turned up.
I think I had a brief moment of, oh my gosh, you know, oh, that's terrible.
Her levels were not much above the average American, and she says she kept nursing her baby because it was the best thing for her. But it did make her think.
I guess I just thought sort of proactively after that, that we need more legislation and research about what those chemicals do and how we can regulate them and how we can control the way they get into our bodies.
Scientists and doctors are worried because hundreds of peer-reviewed studies are suggesting links to problems with brain development, changes to thyroid systems, and fertility problems.
If you're looking at developmental exposure, then these are very toxic chemicals.
Linda Birnbaum is the director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. She studies the health effects of flame retardants. She says there are hundreds of studies in animals showing negative effects from PBDEs. Now, human studies are coming out.
Depending on how high they were exposed in utero, we're seeing associations with some lower IQ and some behavioral deficits. There are also some effects that are beginning to be reported on other reproductive kinds of endpoints in the human population. And all of these kinds of effects have been reported in animal studies.
Birnbaum says the average American has about 30 parts per billion of these flame retardants in his or her body. But some people have levels as high as 10,000 parts per billion. Those are levels where, in animal studies, scientists are seeing problems. One thing the experts say you should keep in mind is that just because you're exposed to a chemical does not mean you'll get sick and die. Dr. Arnold Schechter studies our exposure to flame retardants. He's a professor at the University of Texas School of Public Health.
What we're talking about is not something like cyanide, where if you get some in your body, you're going to drop dead immediately. We're talking about something more like asbestos or cigarette smoking, where you have an effect on a population basis. 80% of lung cancers are from smoking, but the majority of smokers are not going to get lung cancer, so there's some genetic roll of the dice.
Dr. Schechter says you really should try to keep your levels as low as you can, but it can be really tough because these chemicals are everywhere. And despite government policies to reduce our exposures, there's no evidence the levels are going down. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Monday, we'll hear what is and what is not being done by the government to reduce our exposure to flame retardant chemicals. Many people struggling with a rough economy are late on their auto payments. Last year, nearly 2 million cars were repossessed by unregulated repo men or repossession companies. As Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports, some people have lost more than their cars.
On January 12th of this year, Isabel Lovano of San Jose, California, was standing a couple feet from her car when a man jumped in the driver's seat.
And my child was in the back seat, and I did not have a moment to yell or scream.
Lovano called 911, and for the next 30 minutes, she feared she'd never see her son again, until police figured out that the carjacker was actually an unlicensed repo man. She got her son back in about an hour. Lovano was 17 days late on her payment.
You can be 50 cents short or one day late and they can come and get your car. Then I was just really surprised. There should be a law.
33 states have no laws governing car repossession. John Van Alst wrote a report for the National Consumer Law Center. He says since 2006, six people have died during car repossessions gone bad. The center wants states to require advance notice at a minimum, but Van Alst says it would be better for law enforcement to do the repossessing.
And I think if we had these repossessions taking place during daylight hours with an officer that the car owner sort of knew who it was that was taking it, we'd really be able to lower the amount of tension.
But that could be a hard sell, given strained sheriffs and police budgets. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
What a book is worth used to be fairly simple to calculate. There is the author's fee, printing, shipping, and marketing. Calculating the right price for an electronic book is a little different. Consumers think e-books should be cheaper because they cost less to produce, but publishers are afraid if the price goes too low, it will put them out of business. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
E-books, says Jason Epstein, are on the verge of utterly transforming publishing, a business he has worked in for more than half a century.
It is the most exciting event as far as books are concerned in 500 years.
Epstein, a well-known editor, publisher, and author, is a fixture in the book business. Writing about the future of publishing in the New York Review of Books, Epstein noted that many publishers fear e-books will make them obsolete.
There'll be no inventory. There'll simply be digital files, and they'll be available worldwide at the click of a mouse. This makes much of what publishers now do irrelevant. Creating an inventory, putting it in a warehouse, keeping track of it, selling it, shipping it, all that's going to go.
But Epstein says even given all those changes, it's a mistake to assume that at this point an e-book should necessarily cost less than the printed version of a book.
There's a serious misunderstanding there because the publishing companies do today exist and they do have all that overhead and they have to pay for it. And so that has to be figured into the cost of an electronic book. It's not just the cost of transmitting a file. So it's misleading to think that just because there's no physical book that the costs all disappear. They don't.
E-books may be getting all the attention in publishing these days, but that belies the fact that they remain a small fraction of the market. And that, says James McQuivey, an analyst with Forrester Research, is why publishing is in such a tough place right now. A revolution may be underway, but it's by no means complete.
The problem publishers face is that they're organized around analog economics, you know, that are decades, if not centuries old. And so from their perspective, cheaper books threaten that.
McQuivey says publishers know they can't stop the revolution, but they do want to slow it down, and maintaining a higher price for digital books is one way of doing that. They were frustrated when Amazon set the price for e-books at $9.99. So when Apple unveiled the iPad with its e-book reader, they seized the opportunity to make prices more competitive. Now, most of the major publishing houses have negotiated a higher price for newly released e-books. McQuivey says publishers are trying to inhibit the sale of e-books by artificially inflating prices, which he believes is a mistake.
The pricing genie is already out of that bottle, because if you go to Costco, you go to Walmart or Amazon.com, you're going to find hardback books that have been available for 2 weeks that are on sale for $12 and $14 in hardback. How can you explain to a customer that they should pay the same price for a digital edition? It just doesn't make sense.
One person who certainly doesn't see the sense in higher ebook prices is 25-year-old Chris Dannon. A freelance writer who specializes in technology, Dannon makes the argument that ebooks should be dirt cheap. Dannon believes publishers can trim a lot of fat from their budgets right now, cutting back on expenses like marketing, for example. Dannon is sympathetic to publishing's dilemma, but he says they need to leave their old business model behind.
They should be pushing for people to convert to the new medium. They can do whatever they want to support the old medium, the printed medium, but they have to get people used to the idea of buying and reading electronically simply because that's more profitable.
Dannon says publishers should be finding ways to make it easier, not harder, to buy electronic books.
If you're able to get your books in front of more people, which you can when they're electronically distributed, right? If you have iTunes selling your books, you have this entire store right on everyone's desktop, and you can expose them to a lot more. You can just get them into the habit of buying books. And more importantly, you make the process of buying completely frictionless. I mean, when you buy something on Amazon, you have that one-click purchase power.
But Jason Epstein warns the old and the new ways of getting a book to market will be competing with each other for the foreseeable future, and publishers are not yet in a position to abandon their old ways of doing business altogether.
One thing that publishers do have to consider in thinking of pricing is that they don't want to liquidate their existing retail structure by making it so inexpensive to get an e-book that people won't go to bookstores at all. And then publishers will have no place to sell the 90% of the books that they do create in the physical form.
It's too soon for questions like pricing to settle down, says Epstein, but they will eventually. And once things do settle down, Epstein predicts a future for publishing that looks not unlike the past, when a small team of editors helped shepherd a writer's book to market with relatively little interference from management. And that, says Chris Dannon, is the promise of digital publishing for young writers like himself. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Earth and Sky.
We use computer models to predict how the world will respond to carbon dioxide additions to the atmosphere from human activities. And one way of testing them is to apply them to past Earth conditions.
You're listening to Princeton Earth scientist Daniel Sigman, recipient of a 2009 MacArthur Genius Grant. He's been studying past ice ages and says they can help us better understand our current climate warming. For example, during the last ice age, he said, what was happening in the oceans dramatically affected levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide, or CO2.
To the degree that we want to have full information on where the Earth is going, we need to explore this further.
Sigman said ice age data can help strengthen today's climate models by providing a sort of test. He talked about how this has worked for weather models, the kind experts rely on to make our daily forecasts.
Every day the weather model makes a prediction, and every day weather occurs and provides a test of that prediction. This has allowed the models to be improved over time.
Sigman added that there's no doubt that climate warming is happening, but how much and how quickly is uncertain. Sigman said that to improve our models of climate, we need data from long periods of time. More interviews with scientists at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance